welcome to the podcast. My name is Thomas J. Sotvedt.
And I'm Vicky Sotvedt.
So add a demonic possession into the mix, and that means you've got scaredy cats. So, Vicky, have you ever been to an exorcism before?
No, but I don't think that's really surprising, because you have to be a licensed exorcism priest to perform an exorcism, and there's not a ton of them.
Not a ton of them in North America, anyway.
It's true. There's a lot of them in Italy. I think something like 3/4 of licensed exorcist priests are in Italy.
Yeah, they're also really popular in, like, South America, and I believe in Africa there's quite a few licensed exorcists. I think in Canada we have 2.
Yeah. They're mostly in Italy, though.
Mostly all in Italy, yeah. But while I was researching this, I actually remembered a coworker of mine, a woman I used to work with from Colombia, recalls a man in the village. She grew up a little way from Bogota, recalls a man in her village was once actually supposedly possessed by a demon and did a bunch of weird stuff in the village. Was walking around screaming in the wee hours of the morning. Apparently he would attack livestock and stuff, and he went and got exorcised when she was quite young, and she reports that afterwards he was back up and running. So
good to know.
I mean, it's I don't know. I always hear stories like that, and then I also remember that places that tend to have people claiming to be possessed also tend to be places where possessions happen on the regular, right? So a lot of that's hysteria. It's the same as the a lot of people born in Jerusalem report being religiously significant.
Yes.
They report to be themselves messiahs in some way, because it's just kind of what you're raised around, is that sort of influence. So I imagine it's the same with demonic possessions.
Or maybe somebody's actually possessed. We just don't know.
Maybe so. Just not in Canada. We're too nice up here. And I guess down in the United States as well. They don't have too many possessions going on down there, I don't think.
Anyways, we've gone a bit off topic, so let's talk about the only exorcism that matters to the podcast right now.
Right, The Exorcist. It was written and produced by William Peter Blatty, who's also the fellow that wrote the book, directed by William Friedkin. And this is a pretty important horror film to the genre as a whole. Quite a big deal. It was actually the first horror film to be nominated for Best Picture.
Have there been many horror films nominated for Best Picture?
Not a ton, no. It's hasn't been really a very long respected genre. So, no, it's very, 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 I don't know. I don't imagine many have been. I'll just Google it here. I mean, Best Picture horror films.
I don't think any have won. For sure, none of them have won.
No. A Little Shop of Horrors was apparently nominated. The Shining, unsurprisingly. A Psycho 3? That can't be right.
Really?
That can't be right. Hey, anyway, it was the first, though, which is pretty exciting, I guess. Very, very significant horror film. It was actually based on a real life event, the exorcism of one Ronald Doe in Maryland in the mid 1949, somewhere in that area. It was very tabloidy, so it wasn't confirmed by any credible sources, but William Peter Blatty had heard about it, and that's what inspired him to write the book.
Gotcha. So it's not so much based on as inspired by.
Yeah, well, everywhere I'm seeing says it's based on, so I don't know. That's what I'm choosing to go with. Whether or not it's based on or inspired by, who's to say? And of course, he was studying, I think, to be a priest. Anyway, the priest in the movie is actually also the guy, Max von Sydow. He's also the three-eyed raven in Game of Thrones, right before Bran becomes the three-eyed raven. He's the old guy in the tree. So,
and for all of you at home, I'm just looking blankly at Thomas because I've seen a scattered number of Game of Thrones episodes, so I don't really understand Game of Thrones.
There's a lot of people out there that are pumping their fists in the air and going, yeah. Anyway, I guess that's what a life of doing exorcisms gets you, is you get stuck in a tree somewhere way up north where it's cold. So that sucks. Also, in the movie is Linda Blair as Regan McNeil as the possessed little girl. I couldn't find much on what she's done. It looks like she was in a lot of, like, kind of short films, not a lot of like unaccredited roles, but she has been on RuPaul's Drag Race a couple times.
Well, at least she's doing something.
She's doing something. I guess she's on like the RuPaul episodes that are all about spooky horror stuff.
I thought it was the other lady on those episodes with the hair.
I can never remember her name.
Elvira?
Elvira, Lady of the Night, something like that.
Something.
Yeah, I don't know.
She's got the hair.
A lot of kids I grew up with had posters of her on their bedroom wall. Some more fast facts for you. The demon's name in the movie is Pazuzu, which is actually a real-life demon, a actual...
mythological figure, perhaps?
Yeah, exactly.
From ancient Mesopotamia.
Ancient Mesopotamia, yeah. King of demons. Demons of the wind, specifically.
Well, no, he is a demon of the wind, but he's the demon specifically of famine and locusts.
I thought he was okay, well, that's lots of good stuff to be the demon of.
Fun fact, actually, about him.
Yeah.
Even though he's the demon who brings famine and locusts, women in ancient Mesopotamia, when they were pregnant, used to wear amulets of him because he was so bad he scared away the demon of miscarriage. So
the demon of miscarriage would just show up and be like, oh fuck,
right,
never mind.
Right, so that's some fun facts, right, about Pazuzu.
Another additional fun fact is Pazuzu is the name of Professor Farnworth's gargoyle in Futurama, also Pazuzu.
A lot of Pazuzus going around.
Yeah.
I maintain Pazuzu is just the least scary name
I think
ever.
It's a very demon-esque name. Like, you've got things like Screwtape and Beelzebub, and I don't know. They have silly names. Demons have silly names.
I wasn't implying that demons all have really solid names except for Pazuzu. I'm just saying I think Pazuzu is extra, like, ridiculous.
So anyways, that's some fast facts about The Exorcist for everybody at home, which is most people except for us. But I guess I think now is the time to ask Vicky what Vicky knows about The Exorcist. What are you kind of expecting?
It's a demon possession. It's a demon possession. The demon's name Pazuzu. We've established that. There's some Catholic imagery, I think, given that it's like an exorcism, which is a pretty like Catholic thing. I'm pretty sure at some point the girl is, like, spinning on the ceiling, maybe? That's really it. That's the extent of my knowledge on The Exorcist. I feel like a 4 out of 10 confidence level.
Ooh.
'Cause I was talking to some friends at work, and they asked what the next episode this episode was going to be, and I said, The Exorcist, and they went, oh. Well, that ramped up quite a bit from Carrie, so that was a really encouraging statement to hear.
Okay.
But that's about where we're at.
Right, right. Well, I guess we'll see what spooks are in store for Vicky and I, since, again, I mentioned last episode, I have never seen The Exorcist before. It's one of those films that I know is quintessential and very important, but it's just never been on my radar. I've never had the opportunity to watch it. I've never sought it out. I knew I would one day, which is going to be today, I guess. But I've never seen it. But I guess we'll see what Pazuzu the Demon has in store for Vicky and I when we go to attend this exorcism, which I guess is in D.C., not Maryland. So off to D.C. we go to see this exorcism get done. I will pack my crucifix.
And I'll bring the holy water.
Sounds great. And we'll be right back after we finish watching The Exorcist. So stay frosty.
All right. We are back after the exorcism of Regan McNeil, and I am covered in pea soup.
Yeah, I look like a smaller, more disgusting green giant. But you know what? It doesn't smell as bad as I thought it would. You know what it actually reminds me of? A shamrock milkshake.
I hate shamrock milkshakes.
Me too, but there are worse things in the world to smell like. Some people like them, so...
I mean, true. I'm not really trying to smell good for anybody but you.
Yeah, well, I try to smell good for people that I work with.
I practice basic hygiene, obviously, but I'm not choosing perfume and things.
I don't want to be gross for people. Anyway, this is The Exorcist Part 2. And I wanted to quickly start off part two by saying that I have led all you people listening to part one astray, and I hope this doesn't hurt your guys' faith in me in the future. I promise I will always do my best to do my best research, and if I do make any mistakes, to correct them later, because I don't want to lead anyone astray. So I gave you guys a whack list of horror films that had been nominated for Best Picture that included The Little Shop of Horrors and The Extras 3, and that's all just, or Psycho 3, and that's all just so horribly wrong. The actual list is The Exorcist, Jaws, The Silence of the Lambs, The Sixth Sense, Black Swan, and Get Out more recently. Now, I wouldn't personally consider Black Swan or Jaws a horror film. Horror films, they more thrillers to me.
Jaws is on our list of horror movies to watch.
All right, well, there you go. I guess our list has spoken. Anyway, those are the actual Best Picture nominees. And secondly, I said last time that William Peter Blatty may have been studying to be a priest when he wrote The Exorcist. That is absolutely wrong. He was in school studying, but not to be a priest. So those are the two big inconsistencies that incorrect facts that I thought of in between then and now. So I apologize out there. I'll try and do better in the future. All right, with that out of the way, I guess last episode we failed to do this, but this is the part of the episode where we're going to spoil the crap out of this film. We're going to be giving you a synopsis, every little thing that happened, and then give you our thoughts on it.
But also the film is like almost 50 years old, so if you're going to get mad at us for spoilers.
Yeah, go watch it or read the book. If you really want it unspoiled for yourself, then go do those things and don't get mad at us. But you have been warned. You're the type of person that's going to get mad at us. So our film opens with Lancaster Marin, the priest, who is not seen after this point until the last like 20 minutes of the movie, except briefly walking around in Iraq.
Actually, just before that, just before we see the priest, we start with a scene of the sun. And it's black and white, and then it kind of fades into color for a second, and then it goes very red. And it was just starting very early with the color symbolism in this movie.
Yeah, and that's actually something that, and we're going to do our best to cover this movie here, but while the first time I watched, when we watched it just now, there's a lot. It's a long movie. There's a lot of really big scenes that there's no like express dialogue. There's a lot of symbolism. There's a lot of background stuff that I'm sure we're going to miss. So I don't know if you're the type that tends to obsess over finding symbolism and stuff. Don't get angry at us for missing little tiny things, because this movie's so chocked full of it. You could teach a series of classes alone on what everything means.
Do you know what the beginning reminds me of?
What?
Indiana Jones. Like when they're looking for the Ark of the Covenant in the temple, it's like almost exactly the same layout. And actually, that movie was filmed 3 years later, so I almost wonder if it was like just the same set somewhere. Also, I just want to go on record and say that when the priest finds the sculpture of Pazuzu and just like breaks the head of it out of a chunk of rock.
Well, that's it. The amulet.
Yeah, that is not proper archaeological practice.
Terrible, terrible. I was thinking that the entire time. Like, my breath caught in my throat, and that's probably the most scared I was the entire movie. Was like, oh, no.
I'm a historian,
don't break that.
And that just hurt my historian soul to watch them just be like, trunk?
So anyways, yeah, we open on Iraq with the priest, and he's at this dig, this really old temple. And this kid goes running through all the workers. There's a lot of sheep around. And he goes and finds the priest. And we get this kind of interesting shot of the kid's legs kind of looming over the priest. And the priest is kind of crouched down, which to me is very reminiscent of the shot that we get a little bit later when he's staring up at the statue looming over him. I don't know if that's on purpose or whatever. But the kid says, oh, we found something. There's some small pieces that you should look at. And yeah, the priest goes, looks inside this hole, finds the statue thing, as you pointed out, and pries its head off.
Well, it's not actually attached to anything. It's just a head, but he just yanks it out of a chunk of rock. He would correct terminology, as the kids say nowadays, be he yeets it out of the rock?
No, that'd be throwing it. Oh, he pulls.
But he yeets the rock after he
I don't think so. I think he just drops it on the ground.
Chucks it.
Okay, well, I don't know. Jury's out on what he does with the rock afterwards. I'm pretty sure it doesn't matter too much. But anyways, yes, and he takes his little archaeologist brush and he brushes the face off. And this is our first look at the demon in question in this movie. As we mentioned last time, his name is Pazuzu. And it's, again, not mentioned. The name is not mentioned once the entire movie. You're just expected to, if you're familiar at all with demons and ancient Mesopotamian society, I guess between the statue and some of the imagery, you're meant to draw that conclusion. And I think it talks about it a little bit in the book, and I'm sure it talks about it tons in the sequels.
See, this scene raised so many questions to me as somebody who hasn't read the book, to the point I had to, like, go on a Google search after the movie. Because what I wanted to know is, how is the demon operating? Is it like, oh, they found this particular head statue, so now it's free to roam? Is it that it's a priest found it? Like, there's no explanation in the movie for... suddenly, there's a Pazuzu.
Yeah, well, I feel there's a lot of, again, there's just so much symbolism, and there's so many, like, background things that happen, and it's really hard to tell if some of it's on purpose, or if there just happened to be a neat shot, and they were like, let's go with that, yeah, 100%.
I don't know, I just think that they don't actually ever explain the way the demon works, whether or not it was released at the start of the dig, or with the finding of this statue.
Not really,
or if it's just chilling.
But after that, we do get the priest, and he goes back into town, and there's a whole lot of, like, suspicion and people kind of staring at him, and he sits down for a drink, and the server actually pours his drink out of a sort of a, I don't know, drink apparatus thing, but the
carafe.
It's kind of like a carafe, yeah, but the spout of the carafe is very chimera-like, and as those of you who know all about demons and Pazuzu is made up of animal parts. He's very chimera-like, so found that kind of interesting that he's using that to pour the drink for Lancaster Morn.
Yes, and while Lancaster Morn is getting the drink, he's also taking glycerin pills for a heart condition,
and that's not, again, touched on until later. And there's this banging sound, and at some point he ends up finding a blacksmith, where these three dudes are just wailing on this bit of metal with three big hammers, and one of the guys pulls his hat off and looks right at the father, and he's got a misty eye, and he's creepy looking, and I'm sure that is meant to symbolize some creepiness.
Yeah,
I don't know. Again, like, every single scene in this movie could mean a bunch of different things, and I think everybody has its own way of interpreting it. I'm sure some of it was on purpose. I'm sure some of it was just a happy accident. But after that, he ends up getting in his car, and he drives to, I think, his buddy's estate, and these guards come out with their guns and pointed at him. And he doesn't seem to see them or notice them very much.
He waves at them.
Well, later. But at first, he is kind of, like, hunched over, and you can see that there's, like, what looks like a bullet hole, maybe, in his windshield. So maybe he's been shot at by these guys by accident before, but he's kind of hunched over, and he gets up, and he sees them, and then he waves at them, and they kind of just give him, like, a half nod and leave.
Oh, I found that scene much less tense than you're describing. I was like, oh, dudes, oh, yeah, he knows them. Cool.
Yeah, I noticed that there was a bullet hole there, so I don't know if maybe he's had his identity mistaken in the past or something, but anyways, that's what I extrapolated from that. But he goes and he meets his buddy, and his buddy asks if he's going to be sticking around, and the priest, Lancaster Marin, says, nope, I gotta go back. I gotta leave.
And it's unclear if he's going back because he's the only person who knows how to deal with Pazuzu, or if he's just like, man, Iraq is hot.
Yeah.
I want to go home.
Yeah, there's not a lot of explanation given for any of this opening, like, 10, 15, 20 minutes. It's a long time. There's almost no dialogue, and yeah, you can't tell whether or not he's aware that something's going down, or whether or not he's just kind of suspicious of all of it, or he's going back home because it's hot in Iraq, and there's sand everywhere, and it's coarse and irritating, and he hates it, or if he's going back because he knows there's going to be some demon times. But yeah, once he leaves his buddy's place, we cut to the other side of the globe in Georgetown with actress Chris McNeil.
And her daughter.
But I think we start with Chris McNeil, and she's on a film set. It's clearly like a protest film, I think.
It's about student activism,
yeah,
I think.
Yeah. And she gets up there, and she gives a kind of a little speech through a microphone, and And it's over, the scene's over, everybody claps, and she goes and she chats with the director for a little bit.
Burke Dennings.
Burke Dennings, yes. Burke Dennings, who is not long for this world.
Spoilers, Thomas.
Oh, yeah. Well, this movie doesn't have a whole lot of casualties in it. He is one of them. But anyways, talks with her for a bit, and then she goes home, and we meet this future possessed girl, Regan McNeil, or maybe she's already possessed. Who knows?
Yeah, I found it interesting that we never actually see how or when she gets possessed. They have a little kind of conversation, mother and daughter, and like, what are you doing, blah, 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 we're going to have a tickle fight now. And then Regan is showing her mom like what she did that day, and she's found a Ouija board.
Right.
I don't know. There's like five letters, and only one of them is a consonant.
Ouija or Ouija, okay. I don't know.
But anyways, and her mother's like, huh, neat, those are fun, do you know how to use it? And Regan's like, yeah, and then she's using it to contact a spirit she calls Captain Howdy.
Captain Howdy.
Except nothing happens, and you're like, well, that was anticlimactic, and it's not clear. Is it like, is Captain Howdy Pazuzu? Is it some other spirit? Was she possessed before?
Regan is actually apparently talking to Captain Howdy, because the puck thing that you use to talk using the Ouija board isn't moving, and Regan asks Captain Howdy if her mom's pretty, and then she laughs and says, well, that's not very nice, Captain Howdy. So it's clear that
he's not answering her.
Is it because he's not answering, or?
The Ouija board isn't moving, so it's because Captain Howdy isn't answering whoever Captain Howdy is.
The way she delivered that line then, to me, spoke like she was hearing this from Captain Howdy.
No.
She heard something nasty and was like, oh, that's not very nice.
No, because when they're communicating through Ouija boards, it moved, but it didn't move at all. And then Chris is like, oh, well, maybe he's sleeping. Maybe he just doesn't want to talk to you right now.
Okay, yeah.
So, but yeah, and it's semi-implied, I guess, that because Regan plays with Ouija boards is the reason why she's possessed. But, like,
yeah,
very vaguely. And that was one thing I found really interesting, that, like, you know she's possessed at some point, but they don't ever show it.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah, and a fun fact for everybody out there, all Ouija boards are owned by Hasbro. If you are playing with a Ouija board that does not have Hasbro on it, then it is not an official Ouija board, and Hasbro's gonna sue you and all your ghostly friends. Makes them a whole lot less scary if you just think that they're all owned by you. Ouija boards brought to you by Hasbro. Contact your dead friends. Fun times.
Yes.
Anyway, so I think there is a scene either before the Ouija board scene or just after where Chris hears some sounds. It's later in the evening. Chris hears some sounds coming upstairs that are weird.
It's after she's put Regan to bed.
And she goes upstairs to Regan's room to find the window open and the wind blowing. And to me, I thought that maybe that was when Regan gets possessed, because, again, Pazuzu is a demon of the wind. So I thought that could be the moment that's happening. Maybe the Ouija board was like starting to invite him in, and that was the moment. But again, like much of this movie, a lot of it's really up to interpretation, whatever it is you want to think.
It could be. And to be honest, just going back to the window thing, I almost wondered if Stranger Things took some inspiration from The Exorcist, because throughout the film, no matter how hard they try, the window keeps getting open and the room gets colder and colder. And the mind flayer in Stranger Things, who is a demon by all accounts, or at least that world's interpretation of a demon, loves the cold. He hates being hot. So I almost wondered if that was a callback.
Well, it's a really, really common trope in horror films, like ghosts and spooky spirits come around when it's cold.
But
cold
demon's
spots,
not a ghost. Well, demon's supposed to be from, like, the lake of fire.
They're treated the same in a lot of horror films. Like, a lot of movies, they're pretty interchangeable. And cold spots, cold flashes, are often signs of some kind of spirit or malevolent force. I don't know where the origins of that are, but Stranger Things definitely plays off of it, and I'm sure that this movie does as well.
Right. Anyways, there's a house party shortly after.
Yeah, Chris invites over all of her buds from the film, including the director guy.
Right, and is it Burke who's really drunk?
Yeah, and he calls one of the house guests a Nazi.
He calls a couple of the house guests Nazis.
Does he? I thought it was only one guy he's picking on. He calls
I don't know,
a Nazi,
but
and then
there's several moments where he's, like, drunkenly screaming that he was a Nazi in the Gestapo, and how did it feel to kill the Jews? And you're like, what?
Yeah. Just... And I think everybody else is also like, what, dude? Because Chris, I think, removes him from the party and puts his drunk ass in an Uber or something and is like, okay, bye.
They didn't have Ubers in the
1970s. I was making a joke. She says goodbye at the door. She leaves the party very, very shortly, yeah.
And they're all playing the piano, and they're having a generally great time, and Reagan comes downstairs, and they're like, oh, did we wake you up? And she looks at somebody who apparently is an astronaut.
Yeah, I saw that as well, that he is an astronaut.
And she's like, you're gonna die in space. And then she starts peeing on the carpet, and everyone is like...
Which I'm sure is just what you want to hear if you're an astronaut, to have a creepy little girl come downstairs, tell you you're gonna die in space, and then pee on the ground.
Right, and... Chris handles it like a champ. Like, clearly she just thinks Reagan is, like, sick or something.
Or
like, having a fever dream. She's
yeah.
like, okay, let's go upstairs. And she, like, gives her a bath. And
yeah, and then I think it's, like, Chris's assistant, who apparently is, I don't know, important to Chris's character, because they have a moment at the end of the movie, but, like, I didn't really get any characterization from her. I just know that she's Chris's assistant.
Yeah.
I don't know why we should care about her too much. But she cleans up the pee on the carpet.
Yes, and in the morning after the house party... We cut to the church.
I think that night the bed shakes.
Oh, right, that is true.
Yeah.
The bed is shaking.
Yeah,
and they're all screaming.
Chris hears Regan screaming from a room and goes into the room, and the bed's shaking.
Yeah.
And they get on the bed, and it's crazy.
It is. But anyways, next morning, cuts to the church, and Dimitri. Or Dimmy, as his mother calls him. The other priest in the film is showing up.
The boxer.
Yeah, he's showing up. He's bringing some flowers.
Mm-hmm.
Life is fine and dandy. And then it cuts to the statue of the Virgin Mary, and she's grown, like, bloody, weird, spiky tits and a penis. And
somebody's defaced the statue, clearly covered it in blood. And
but it's not even defaced. It's clear the statue has grown these, if you actually look at it, which... I'm fascinated that doesn't come up again in the movie. Nobody else is like, did you notice the statue of the Virgin just grew some weird phallic growth and was covered in blood?
Like, who knows, the Virgin Mary had some BDSM kinks.
Like,
that's neat.
If that happened in the real world, I guarantee the Vatican would have had a whole team in there within 12 hours.
Well, if people are freaking out about Jesus' face on some toast... And that's, like, enough to make news and stuff? Then, yeah, you bet.
Pope would be involved. The Vatican would have a special investigative team. And it's never addressed again. Everyone's like,
one of the issues I have about this movie is that, like, people seem very slow to react in this film. And really, really slow to jump to any sort of conclusions. Like, they want to really make sure before they take any sort of decisive action. And it's a little bit frustrating when you're a viewer because you're sitting there like, okay, this little girl is clearly possessed. Her head's just spun round. There's a demon.
No, it's
there's
clearly
demon stuff
a
everywhere.
Lesion in her temporal lobe.
Oh, if she'd only taken that Adderall.
Ritalin,
right.
the doctors really wanted to take Ritalin. They're like, it's ADD. And then they're like, it's a lesion in her temporal lobe. And then they're like, well, we did this really intense brain scan that's actually kind of mildly traumatizing to watch on film.
Yeah, it's really like... medically accurate, and there's needles and stuff.
Yeah, it's not great. That part of the movie I didn't like. But then they're like, we found nothing in her brain, but we'll do it again because there must be a lesion in her temporal lobe. And it's like, well, there comes a point when you have to acknowledge that maybe it's not a lesion on her temporal lobe.
Yeah, this entire movie could be a big long commercial for. Yeah.
Yeah. But then Chris is really starting to get frantic at this point. She clearly believes something is wrong with Reagan beyond ADD or ADHD or whatever. And she's just come home and she's having a stressful day.
Oh, and throughout all this, she keeps hearing like sounds in the walls in the attic. And she says that it's rats and the help of the house, I think, like, their butler or whatever, is like, it's not rats. I promise. It's not rats. And I think at the beginning of the film, she gets him to get traps.
Yes.
And after Regan gets taken to the psychiatrist and gets tested and stuff like that, she actually goes up to the attic. And here's where most horror films would have some kind of jump scare, some shadow or something like that, some sort of something. But she goes up the attic and doesn't actually find anything. She finds the... mousetrap has not been sprung, and
the candle flares up, though. That's like a tiny jump scare.
Oh, right. The candle does light up, which is a little spooky. I wouldn't call that a jump scare. but I don't know.
A Twitch scare?
That's not a thing.
I'm trying to make funny commentary.
All right, Twitch scare.
All over
If you want to go ahead and TM that, then you go right ahead.
I will. I will TM that.
I think it's more like random gas pocket. But and then she turns around and the butler guy is like, "I told you there's no rats." His head's like poking through the, and she's like, "Yeah, whatever." Yeah. And anyways,
but anyways,
that happens.
Chris has had a really stressful day, and she comes home after all these tests, and one of her friends from the film comes in and is like, "Have you heard the news?" And she's like, "What?" And he's like, "Oh, Burke died." And she's like, "What?" And he's like, "Yeah, he fell out of your daughter's window broke his skull."
And he was
like,
babysitting, I guess. And so at some point the next day. And another thing, and I think we've been forgetting him, is the other guy in the film, the Father Karras?
Yeah.
Father Karras, yeah. He has almost as much screen time as Chris and Regan. There's a lot spent on his life. We learn that he is having a crisis of faith. He doesn't want to be a priest anymore. We also learn that his mom is having some problems.
No, his mom dies at the beginning of the movie.
Is it at the beginning of the movie? Doesn't she go visit her?
He goes to visit her, and then she like dies like the next
day. Yeah, we learn that she has problems, and then he visits her in the hospital, and they can't afford to give her the care that she needs. Because the United States is healthcare. And then she dies. And he feels really guilty about it because he feels like he didn't give her the care that she deserved. And all this time he's having a huge crisis of faith. We also learn that he's a boxer. He spends some time at the gym beating the heck out of a punching bag. I think after his mom is in the hospital before she dies.
I think it's after she dies.
I think it's before. I think it's when she's in the hospital and he's like,
he's punching the punching bag though.
Yeah, we learn that he's a bit of a Rocky Balboa. Balboa? Yeah. Rocky.
I haven't seen that movie either.
He's a bit of a Sylvester Stallone.
Yes. But yeah, right after Chris learns that Burke has died, Regan crab walks backwards and upside down the stairs and then vomits blood everywhere.
Yeah, and
somehow people are still like, psychiatry.
Yeah, it's like after that, I'd be kind of possessed, obviously possessed. No human being can crab walk down the stairs at such speed and then vomit out blood, like, let alone vomit out blood and then crab, like, I don't know. It was very, very clearly possessed, but apparently that's not enough. And again, this is one of the only big problems I've got with the film, is that everybody seems so slow to jump to any sort of conclusions. So it takes that incident, and then a little bit later, they go back up to Regan's room, and she's, like, stabbing herself in the vagina with a crucifix.
Apparently she's supposed to be masturbating.
It did not look like masturbating to me. There was some stabbing sound effects, and there was blood. But anyway, and she's, like, screaming obscenities at people, telling people to fuck her, and in this really kind of gravelly voice. And actually, a neat fact, the voice actress that is the demon voice in Regan, in order to get ready each day, would, like, smoke a pack of cigarettes and, like, drink nothing but, like, whiskey and, like, eggs and stuff like that to get her voice nice and gravelly.
Hmm. Sounds like an unfortunate job.
I think that was her choice to get into, like, character. Again, it works. That demon sounds exactly like she did those things.
It's true. But yeah, after this, they're like, okay, we may need an exorcism.
Something's fishy here.
Although, I will point out, the doctors don't suggest an exorcism because she's crab walking backwards down the stairs and throwing up blood and stabbing herself in the vagina.
No. She still just might have ADD.
Right. They're like, in these circumstances, people who believe that they're possessed can benefit from exorcisms. And it's like,
like, the belief that you're possessed is enough that you can spin your head around and crab walk down the stairs.
Yeah.
Like the placebo of being possessed gives us superhuman stretchy abilities.
You know, I've believed many things in my life, and none of them have allowed me to turn my head 180 degrees.
Yeah, I've tried. It's not. I tried. I believed as hard as I could that there was a demon in me, and it didn't work. So,
yeah.
Not ADD.
Anyways, I find it interesting, too, that the film is like, it'll be really hard to find an exorcism, though. They never happen anymore. That's not true. Exorcisms do still happen. They are rare.
Yeah.
There's at most a handful in a year, but to claim that there are no exorcisms ever anymore is quite factually inaccurate.
Mm-hmm.
But anyways, they call the priest, Dimmy.
Yep.
I can't for the life of me ever remember his last name every time. He's just Dimmy in my head forever. But they call Dimmy, and he's like, okay, well...
Damien. He's Damien.
I know, but they call him Dimmy because of his mother, and it just sticks in my head as Dimmy.
All right.
But anyways, he comes, and he's like, okay, well, I have to totally verify that she's possessed. Which is actually true, that priests cannot perform exorcisms unless they have ruled out all possibility of mental illness, external stimuli, anything. So, that is true. He does have to have solid evidence.
Yeah, so he shows up and he quotes some scripture at her and he throws some holy water on her and she flails around and then she starts speaking backwards, I think, at him in another language. And that's one of the actual things that they do to test people out to see if they're possessed is if they speak a if they're speaking in a language that they don't know.
Right. And then the other thing that happens is he's also a doctor, so he's like taking her heart rate and stuff. They watch scars appear on her stomach that say "Help me." And I don't know about you, but if I ever saw that in another human being, I would not need then to go to other people and be like, so she might be speaking in a different language. That, for me, the appearance of spontaneous scars saying "help me" would be solid.
She was either speaking Latin or she was very drunk and slurring her words. I think she also, at this point, pukes all over him. The green slime.
She does.
Oh, yeah. Projectile vomit. So that's good enough for him. He's pretty convinced at that point that this little girl is possessed by a demon.
Yes.
And I think at that point he goes to, like, the College of Priests or whatever, visits the head of his order.
No, I think he just visits the main priest from his church to get permission.
Right. Yeah, I was making a joke about... Anyway, priests being wizards. But, he goes and visits, like, the head priest guy, and the head priest guy is like, oh, man, I know a guy for this, and agrees to send a letter to Father Lancaster Marin from the start of the movie. Remember that guy?
Yeah, and his bad archaeology.
Yeah, and his bad archaeology, way from the beginning of the movie. And this has been most of the movie at this point. And we have not had mention nor seen this guy. I don't know. We weren't watching the director's cut, by the way. And I know the director's cut has some extra scenes, so I'm not sure if any scenes involve him. But we were not watching the director's cut. So he's not mentioned until this point.
Right, but he does answer the summons, mm-hmm. and he shows up. And he's extremely chill. And let me just say, as somebody who doesn't like horror movies, that was very reassuring that, like, he was not freaking out. He was not the least bit concerned. It did not matter what demon shit was going down in that room.
It's interesting.
It was handleable.
Because the entire movie, I don't know. I got the sense, especially when he gets, there's a scene where he gets the letter, wherever he's at, whatever abbey he's at. And he seems pretty calm about it. He's like, all right. He shoves the letter in his pocket and continues on with his walk. And then we don't see him again until he comes to do the exorcism. But there's a couple different scenes, I think, at the beginning and him clearly looking at the Pazuzu statue sort of knowingly. And then when he comes to do the exorcism, we get the iconic shot of him getting out of the taxi cab, standing underneath the lamplight in his hat and his briefcase that is... And actually, for everybody out there, like, I thought that was the start of the film. I thought that that's where the film was going to start, was with that scene. I thought the whole movie was the exorcism. I had no idea the exorcism was only, like, the last 20 minutes in this two-hour film. But as he enters the house to go and... I think maybe even before this, we see Regan lying in bed, and it's kind of like superimposed over his face as if like the demon's communicating with him or as if he can hear Regan. And the demon in Regan whispers, "Marin, Marin," almost like the demon knows who he is. So I almost wonder if this is sort of like an old grudge.
According to Wikipedia, in the book, they have interacted before.
Yeah. So I got the feeling that this was like a grudge match kind of like exorcism. Like maybe Father Lancaster Mirren had exorcised Pazuzu before out of somebody.
Yes.
And then, so this is kind of like the demon basically saying, you know, come at me, guy.
Yeah. It's worth noting too at this point that Regan is tied down with restraints.
Yes, because she has gotten extra crazy at this point. She's full on possessed. Her face is all gummed up with scars and stuff. Her eyes are like a greenish red. Her voice is entirely the demon now. She's screaming profanities at people. We get the scene of him standing under the lamplight, the iconic shot. Then he walks into the house, and while he's greeting Damien and Chris, the demon, Pazuzu, calls him up from upstairs in the room. Actually screams his name, which again, I think reinforces the fact that they know each other and right. that they've met before.
Yeah, and then Marin sends Damien to get the crucifix, the holy water, and the purple stole.
Yeah, which I was sort of like, man, you didn't bring that?
Well, the purple stole is not supposed to leave the church.
Oh, okay.
So you wouldn't take it out of the church before, because it's what you wear at the altar.
But, like, I don't know. If I was on my way to exorcism, I'd make sure I had holy water.
Well, it's also not his church, right?
That's true. I guess you can't, not any old priest can just roll up and be like, look, I've got the collar thing. Give me some holy water.
Well, actually, that I think you can do.
Oh, well, there you
go. Technically anybody, fun fact, technically anybody can make holy water, even if they're not a priest, but it has to be like, if you're not a priest, it has to be like to give somebody their last rites or something.
Right, which we see at the end of the film get done.
Right. Well, he does last rites. He doesn't make holy water.
Well, maybe he's sweating a whole lot, so I don't know.
Bless this sweat.
There you go.
But yeah, so I found as the exorcism was starting that it was almost anticlimactic. Like, Marin is... calm might be the wrong word, but Marin is very... stoic.
Yeah, well, again, I think that just speaks to, like, this isn't his first rodeo. It's gonna be his last, but it's not his first rodeo. And so, after Damien returns with the stuff, they settle in for the... Actually, before that, the father, while Damien's getting the stuff, the father's offered tea by Chris, and she asks if he wants bourbon in it.
Brandy.
Brandy, right. And he says, my doctors say I shouldn't, but thank God my will is weak. And takes the brandy in his tea. And then after that, the exorcism starts. And it's, like, for me, this is where the movie really started. I don't know. This entire, you know, like, hour and 40 minutes just felt like a big, long buildup. And I don't know. This movie is... Well, we'll get to it a little bit more in the ratings, but, like, not a ton really happens. There's not a lot of spooky moments, but for me, this is where it started getting kind of intense, because I don't think there's very much music. The acting is pretty good, and, yeah, they just start exercising, and she's saying all kinds of stuff. She's asking them to, like, stick his dick up her ass and stuff like that. She's saying all kinds of nasty stuff at them.
I find it really interesting that you find this the moment where it gets... starts getting tense, because, like, I don't know, at the point where she turns her head around is uncomfortable, but that's as close as I got to fear in that whole scene was uncomfortable.
Yeah, and again, we'll get to how scared you were when we do the scare ratings, the spook ratings, but anyway, so they start doing the exorcism. It's exactly how you'd imagine. They're sprinkling holy water on her, they're quoting the Bible, they're doing Father, Son, and the Holy Ghost, left, right, and center, and she's writhing around on the bed, screaming at him.
I thought the child actress actually was extremely good in that regard. Like, she manages to convey being in pain but also angry extremely well for somebody whose whole role is to flop around on a bed.
Sure,
like,
yeah.
I thought she did a really good job.
Yeah. So anyways, yeah, she's flailing around and screaming as they're doing their thing.
Yeah, and then the first attempt to exorcise, Pazuzu fails.
Right, she ends up puking all over... I think she pukes all over the bed, and he uses the
stole,
the purple thing, and he wipes it up and then gives it to Damien, and Damien washes it off in the sink, and then he just puts it back on. So I don't know. I guess Damien did a real good job cleaning it up.
Well, I think it's being used as a holy symbol of protection rather than any kind of...
Sure. It'd be, like, smelly protection after that, I imagine.
Well,
shamrock protection.
But But yeah, and I'd like to point out, too, that in real exorcisms, insofar as you believe an exorcism can or cannot be real, that's not uncommon for you need to, like, exorcise, like, 3 or 4 or 5 times.
Yeah. And
the trick is, like, you gotta do it, sit down, have a glass of water, and then you gotta do it. And you gotta do it, like, constantly, because each time, like, weakens the demon until he gets kicked out.
And interestingly, because it's hinted a lot, or it's talked about a lot through the movie, and you see it a little bit, how Damien is a boxer. And the fact that they have to go a few rounds with Pazuzu kind of reminded me of boxing, because Pazuzu's exhausted, lying on the ground, panting towards the end of the first bit, no longer screaming at them. Both of the priests and the Damien and the father are very exhausted as well, and they have to kind of sit out. So it reminded me kind of like round one, round two, round three, which again speaks to him, Damien, being a boxer, and also the fact that it's clear that Father Lancaster Marin and Pazuzu, this is not the first time that they've gone at it.
Right. Also, they're both the father, technically.
Well, yeah, yeah.
I just wanted to say, you keep calling one of them the father and one by their name, and I'm like,
well, yeah, because he's called Damien a lot in the film.
That's true.
Anyway, so yeah, they decide to go round two, but it goes badly, because the Pazuzu starts talking like Father Damien's mom.
His dead mom.
His dead mom.
Deceased.
His recently deceased mom. And is like, you failed me, and you didn't help me out, and I'm in hell because of you, and blah, blah, blah. And this gets to Damien. And Lancaster Marin says, before the exorcism begins, actually warns him, you know, all the attacks are going to be mental. Like, he's going to try and mess with us, and you can't listen to him. And so Damien clearly totally forgets that advice and jumps on Pazuzu and is like, shut up, shut up. And the father kind of like calls it early, throws in the towel for that round. They both leave the room again. And Damien's so clearly shaken by this that he seems like he's going to sit it out after that.
Mm-hmm. But then Chris comes back in the room and she sees Damien and she has this great like, is it over? Did you save her? And he's like,
is she going to die?
Yeah.
Is what she asks.
And Damien has this moment where he just goes, no, and he turns around and he goes back up to the room.
When he
enters
rallies.
The room, he's got a surprise, though, because Marin has died of a heart attack.
Yeah, Marin goes back in to do the rest of the exorcism on his own. And we actually see, there's a scene before Damien sitting down, where we see him get down on his hands and knees, and he starts praying with his hands up like that. And that's the last we see of the doctor alive, or the father alive. Last we see of the father alive. Yeah. So, Damien does go back upstairs after, like, no, she's not going to die. He walks in, and, yeah, he's on the ground, I think, dead as a doornail, heart attack.
Yeah, and I would like to point out, it's never really established whether or not this was Pazuzu, because, like, the movie has twice shown him taking glycerin pills for a heart condition, so it might just be the strain, it might be something Pazuzu did, it might be that man's like 80 and his ticker just couldn't keep up.
Yeah.
It's never established in the film.
Well, and I think that before that scene, we see the father take more glycerin pills, and he's clearly like his heart's bothering him. And I don't know if that's, again, just the stress of everything or if it's the influence of Pazuzu. But
it's, the movie has a very low body count, and like we can't even attribute that one to the demon.
No. Father Damien sees him on the ground and jumps on top of him and is like thumping at his chest with all of his boxer muscles trying to resuscitate him, but it ain't no good. It ain't no thanks. Not happening.
Right. And then he and Pazuzu Reagan kind of go at it, and he ends up on top of Pazuzu Reagan.
He just starts beating her up like this. He like tears her off the bed and pins her to the ground and punches her a couple times, and I'm like, oh man, that's still a little girl technically, man. What are you doing?
But he starts screaming the demon should take him instead.
Yeah, and it's actually very quick. Like, blink if you can blink and you'll miss it, because it's a lot of people yelling and stuff. But yeah, he says, you know, take me. And I think he only says it twice, and it's very, like, kind of garbled, because he's clearly trying to, like, pin this demon down. He's screaming, he's angry, take me, take me.
Yeah, and the demon leaps into him, and he, just before he's fully possessed, leaps out a window, the same window Burke fell out of.
Before that, he gets up, and it's clear his face is all changed, his eyes are all red as well, and he looks down at Regan and starts to bear down on her again. Like, he's clearly possessed, he's gonna attack Regan, who is now totally unpossessed, she looks totally normal, and he's bearing down on her, but you can see him kind of, like, pull himself back, and that's when he looks at the window and just throws himself out instead.
Right, and breaks his skull, and
there's a big, long him falling down the stairs.
Yeah, and
scene.
Father Dyer, and isn't that just some nice name symbolism, Father Dyer?
Which is Damien's buddy throughout the film.
He shows up just in time to give Damien his last rites.
Yeah, he bears down on him and is like, do you repent all your sins that you've committed in this life? And Damien manages to give, like, crippled thumbs up, like, yeah.
And it's not clear, but it's sort of suggested that in doing these last rites, while Damien is still there, but not quite dead, that somehow banishes Pazuzu?
Well, I don't know, because when he's on the ground, we don't get a good look at his face, so we can't see if he's still all possessed and creepy.
No, but he is able to respond to the last rites.
He gives, like, a little, like, nod kind of thing, yeah. So I think that's him rallying one last time, purify my soul, and then he dies, and a big crowd starts to gather. And we cut back to Regan's room, and she's in the corner screaming. She doesn't know what's going on. She doesn't remember anything. And Chris goes and grabs onto her, and the two embrace, and we kind of, like, fade out to the next day, I think.
I don't think it's the next day. I think it's a little
days
down the road.
Yeah.
And they're selling the house. They're going back to where they came from.
Yeah, the secretary quits. The secretary to Chris is, like, I guess, traumatized by this whole event. Doesn't want to work for her anymore. But
I thought it was just she didn't want to move.
Oh, I don't know. The two of them end up hugging, and it's like, miss you, bye. And then, they head out, and the father, Dyer, is there. And the police chief. The police chief shows up a couple times in this movie. He doesn't seem to add a whole lot. The entire character was weird to me. He said a lot of strange things, and none is more stranger than at the end of this movie. But before that happens, Regan, now totally unpossessed, sees Father Dyer's collar and lunges at him. And I was like, oh shit, she's gonna rip his throat out or something. She's still possessed, oh my god. But no, she kisses him on the cheek instead. And I don't know whether or not that was intentional red herring to make you be like, whoa, and then, oh, okay. But that happens.
I don't know. Although I didn't at any point think she was about to go rip his throat out, I'll be honest. Like, at no point was I like, oh, no!
Oh, I totally did. It was like, oh, God. But, yeah, that didn't end up happening. And then, I think Damien's necklace ends up getting...
No, that's the amulet that Marin had at the beginning.
No, it's because Damien's got that necklace, remember? And Chris finds it in the bedroom and tries to give it to Father Dyer.
Right, but that's Marin's necklace.
I'm pretty sure it's Damien's.
Because Marin has the Pazuzu thing, and then he looks at the little amulet and is like, oh, it's not of the same age.
Oh, okay. Well, I don't quite remember whose it is. But
there's
anyway,
an amulet of protection against
there's
people.
An amulet, and Chris tries to give it to Father Dyer and is like, you should have this. And then he's like, nah, you have it, and gives it back to her. And then her and Regan drive away. And then Father Dyer walks up the street, briefly pauses on top of the stairs that Father Damien threw down. There's no indication that not just one, but two people. There's no indication that two people have died there recently. No police tape or nothing. And then he turns down the street, I guess choosing not to take the stairs. And that's what it looked like to me.
Smart man.
Yeah, I wouldn't want to take those stairs. And he meets the police detective who is, I guess, investigating the murder or something like that. But he's too late to interview Chris.
Yeah, she's already gone.
She's already gone. And the two of them walk together down the street, and the police inspector's like, do you like watching movies? And the
Father Dyer?
Father Dyer's like, yep, sure do. And he's like, I got a couple tickets. And I was like looking at him like, man, this guy's so creepily starved for friendship. Like, it's weird, but,
yes.
After
but
that...
they go to the movies.
No, they don't go to the movies, because the father's already seen the movie that the police chief wants to go see.
They're going to a different movie.
They know they're going to lunch.
Oh.
Because, yeah.
They're gonna hang out. They're gonna be bros.
Yeah, yeah, and Father Dyer looks okay with it, but me, Thomas, thought it was weird. But anyways, yeah, he goes, do you got any lunch plans? And the Father Dyer goes, no, not at all, and they leave. And that's where we fade out. And that's The Exorcist.
So, now that... that's over. We're at the portion where we give a breakdown of what we thought of the movie overall. So, why don't we go ahead and rate it on a scale of 1 to 10, how well it's made. Do you want to give what the scale is?
Yeah, so it's 1 to 10, 1 being it barely counts as an experience, and 10, it could never, ever be improved upon by any means. I liked it. I don't know. I didn't at first, weirdly, but I thought it was...
Well, this isn't liking it. This is just how well the movie was made.
Right, right, right. So, yeah. How well it was made? I would say it was made well. It's an artsier film than I thought it was going to be. I think that there's a lot here. I think that you could watch it 100 times and still notice things that you didn't before. So, in that sense, I think that... it's very well made. A lot of decisions are very, very thought out and purposeful. And the acting is good, and the dialogue, even though it's sparse, and even though there's a lot of scenes where not a lot seems to happen, I think it was well made. So I'm going to give this a solid 8 out of 10.
Okay. I think a 7. I think it's, like, it's well filmed, and I mean, like, just how uncomfortable you feel during, like, the medical scenes and stuff, and, like, the practical effects for the time are really good, but I don't know. And I don't know if it's just because we were watching the director's cut. I didn't even know there were different versions of the film. But just the way the editing is kind of makes a lot of cues lost in translation. And, like, it makes it cloudy. So I'm going to give it a 7.
All right. Yeah, that seems fair. All right. So next for us on a scale of 1 to 10, 1 being you were praying for the sweet release of death the whole time, and 10 being it changed your life forever for the better. How much did we enjoy it? So, as I mentioned, I actually did enjoy it, but I enjoyed it a day later. That's the thing, is when it was over, I kind of sat and thought to myself, man, that was sort of overrated. I don't know. It didn't blow my mind like a couple of movies that were made around the same time do that are horror films. But a day later, when I really sat down to think about all the different scenes and how they interplayed together and how there's a lot of subtle story, I actually did enjoy doing that, being able to take some time to think about it. And so, yeah, I think how much I enjoyed it, I'm going to give a 7, which might seem kind of low, but that's only because I didn't, like, pump my fist in the air as soon as it was over and be like, yeah, one more time. I had to really think about it.
You're much more generous than me. I'm going to give it a 5 because, like, there were some moments of tension. The crab walking down the stairs and throwing up blood comes to mind. The medical comes to mind. But, like, there was so much exposition between every moment of tension that I found a lot of the film, I was just bored. And I was like, okay, I can't start looking at the news. I can't start looking at GameSpot. I can't talk to somebody over text. I have to pay attention to the movie. Gotta do it. You know, like, it was just very difficult.
Yeah, that's fair. And again, I think that there's a lot of artistic value, but I'd say for your average person, like your average moviegoer, especially in 2019, is probably going to be bored for a lot of The Exorcist. So lastly, the question on everyone's mind, I'm sure, is how spooky is it, this long movie? 1 being angry puppies are scarier, and 10 being it makes legit exorcisms look like a walk in the park. For me, I would describe the exorcism itself in the last 20 minutes as tense, but not necessarily scary. I was never afraid. There was some spooky imagery in it, so I don't think it's Carrie levels of not scary. I'm going to give it a 2 for me. So just 1 point above Carrie. I imagine I would be a lot more spooked if I had a more religious background. Like, I maybe there's a lot of perversion and stuff that would upset me if I was a little bit more uppity and was raised in a more conservative household. I might be a little bit more horrified than some of the stuff, but I don't know. I was raised in the woods, and so that is well close to it. So it didn't scare me too much. So yeah, 2.
I also am going to give it a 2, which for me is, since I was going into this like white knuckle, like, oh man, how am I gonna survive? Like, I've heard about this. It's supposed to be tense, and I just was bored.
Yeah.
So, 2. I was scared 2 out of 10.
2 out of 10. All right. Well, let's hope that we are able to do a little bit better than that. 1 and a 2 so far doesn't really bode well for how spooky the films that we are watching so far are. But
you know, it does bode well that I may be able to handle this whole project better than I thought.
Yeah, maybe. We'll see when we get into more of the intense stuff, how quickly you ramp it up to 10 there from 1 to 2. Might be like 1, 2, 8, 10. Anyway, that concludes episode 2 of Scaredy Cats with The Exorcist. Next up for us is some sweet, sweet bacon. Kevin Bacon, that is.
With a side of giant worms.
Yes, we are watching Tremors. So grab your graboids and join us then. But for now, I'm Thomas J. Sopvet.
And I'm Vicky Sopvet.
Good night and be cool to each other.